Key, in a very real sense, these two books that we have sum it all up for your lifestyle enrichment. The one, if you leave out the adjective Christian, which I don't like, anyhow, there's only one life, and that's Jesus Christ, finally, so we'll leave it lifestyle enrichment. But those who try to make it without him have no finer statement of it than what we have from John Stuart Mill on liberty. It's the best statement of what we mean by a liberal democracy and on whether or not really a democracy can make it without its roots in Jesus Christ. As a profound person in the 20th century on the many ways opposite side of Christianity still has felt it can't be done, as D.H. Lawrence, for example, in his Democracy in America, or De Tocqueville, who's a very penetrating French critic in the last century, says apart from a deeply felt and shared religious conviction, it just can't come off, the kind of a democracy we have going in America. And finally, it's a real question. One of the great things about this presidential campaign is how much that's once more back central to it. And we can thank Jimmy Carter, not least for that, but it's very much in there on all sides. And is, again, a part of the discussion that's bicentennial. It's a very much a central part of the discussion to it. On to what extent are we in debt to the Christian tradition for even enjoying the possibility of a nation like the USA? And it's a real question. And naturally, there are people within it who don't want to be in debt to it at all. And from a statistical point of view, perhaps in a majority. And yet, I believe, and many of us are profoundly convinced they're dead wrong. Apart from this conviction that in Jesus Christ has revealed for man a possibility of a life together that we enjoy with full discussion, full freedom, full confidence that conversation that's open, that's openly shared, even with some heat and debate like it is here in the village, where we sometimes say, let's cool off in the sauna now and give each other a back rub, but at least the freedom not only of speech for which Mill is arguing and the freedom of the press for which he's arguing, but also something else that's very much here in Mill, and he's also arguing for that. And that's the freedom to hear, the freedom to actually give the other fellow full weight for what he's saying. And that's very much in it. That's part of the beauty of this particular essay. And it's very much there, which sometimes we Christians are very loath to do and are poor to hear. And so it's worth reading for all of us from the point of view of the finest statement of humanism as such. And we have to say of Christian humanism. It's impossible, as Mill himself says in here, to discuss what he's discussing apart from overtones and echoes that come from the tradition, Christian tradition. That he has no real understanding, those of you who have read it, of what Christianity is all about, any more than maybe the stove. In fact, the stove may understand more what Christianity is about because it's shared in some good discussions here. It's true. He doesn't. And you see that from Marcus Aurelius and what he has to say about him. Like, for instance, wouldn't it have been great if instead of Constantine, Marcus Aurelius had introduced Christianity? If Marcus Aurelius had introduced Christianity, what we would have had was a Masonic lodge all over the place, and we wouldn't have a church, but we would have a pretty strong Masonic lodge, and he's kind of a hero of them. And if you want to read something dull, boring, and very, very trite, read him. And also, as his tutor wrote to him, Seneca wrote to him once, Dulce est discipere in loco. It's one of those Latin tags I learned when I was reading it, because it hits it on the head. It's great to be silly once in a while, Marcus. If you could just learn to laugh, he goes on to say. Learn to laugh. Well, he never did. A moralist can't. The nonsense aspect of living that we'll address a little bit in our brief proclamation that I'm going to share tonight, it's going to be a little different proclamation. We'll address that a little bit. But the possibility of laughter at yourself, is not possible within a humanist setup. And John Stuart Mill has no laughter in here, as you know, who read it. But it's beautifully done. It's logically developed. It's a clear style. It's very much in the Aristotelian tradition of unity, coherence, and emphasis, and you got it all the way through, and it's fun to read, and I hope you will. It is, in essence, what we mean by liberal arts education, what we try to protect through our university and college structure within the English-speaking world, and on the continent as well. And in most faculties, in most nations, you will find a very openness to debate and discussion such as he is arguing for here. Okay, that's the first point I make. This is his finest statement. On the other side, we'll have Works of Love, which is the finest statement that I know of on the opposite side of the picture, that the only way in which it can come off to have a truly human existence is to know the living Christ. Kierkegaard, of course, wrote that before this is written. He's dead by the time this is written, actually. But Kierkegaard already answers this whole thing by saying, Uden Christendom Storik Naborn, that outside of Christianity, the neighbor doesn't exist. And then he answers it another way, in a different book entirely, and it's simply saying that if I were convinced there was a concept of sin outside of Christendom, I would cease to be a Christian. Now this cuts right to the core of this book, or of anybody who would go along with this book not understanding why it is not a Christian statement, but a magnificent humanist one. And that is that it's impossible to be a sinner apart from the revelation of God in Jesus Christ, which you now refute and refuse. The world will be convinced of sin because it believes not on me, as John puts it. That sin is unbelief. Sin is not believing that tenderness is at the heart of the universe, that there's a pain in the midst of existence over our refusal to acknowledge God's presence and our practice of the absence of God, so that love becomes an impossibility, justice a mere possibility, and only a rough one. Well, that's the two statements I would say that really are exciting. Each one, I would say, is the mountain peak of human experience within Western society under the influence of the Christian tradition that is continually shaped by our Lord Jesus Christ. Humanly speaking, this is the best statement I know. And it does speak to something that you oftentimes wished you had in the congregation. I would have given sometimes a great deal to have somebody on a board, either in the congregation or in the youth movement or here at the village, who's had a clear understanding of Mill and is willing to argue from these premises at a board meeting. As Dr. Osgard used to tell me when I'd kick once in a while because we had some Masons on our church boards who just didn't know what Christianity is all about, and he said, Carol, they're at least fair-minded. And he says, that's something you could wish a converted Christian might have occasionally, is a little fair-mindedness. And this is true. This is what he's arguing for, what we essentially know is fair-mindedness. That's the shaping image of the English-speaking world, incidentally, that word, fair-minded. And in your New English translation, occasionally, dikaiosyne, the basic word of Greek civilization, the basic shaping word of the Bible, is translated fair-minded. It's another translation for righteousness, as we know it, or justification, fair-minded. And this is speaking to that. In prison camp, we used to say, and I oftentimes repeated it because I never was asked, and I wish the guards had asked me, because they were asking other fellows occasionally, and they never did ask me, who's going to win the war? Because I had my answer ready. The side that isn't afraid to hear what the other side has to say. Now, he refutes this in here. He thinks people win the war with bigger battalions. I remember one argument up here when Will Hartzell was in the midst of something, and there was a very anti-black one in the midst of a Presbyterian elder, viciously anti-black, and furious with me because I said, when the time comes that we have a black revolt in America, and you're speaking about our tanks, they'll turn them, what are you going to do against our tanks? Toothpicks will turn over our tanks. And they will. Because you cannot finally win any war where there is a lack of morale. We proved that in Vietnam, didn't we? I mean, when you come to the armament, the guns, etc., we had them. But we sure didn't have any morale. We were where we didn't belong and we knew it. And we talked about they being the aggressor. And I remember the truck drivers the morning after Nixon giving that speech, and I'd heard about three times through the night because I was driving through the night and having breakfast in Wenatchee. And I'd driven through the night from the afternoon, all these truck drivers been driving, and I'd listened to it about three, four times too, and they're all laughing. And said, boy, it's wonderful, isn't it, how we can be the aggressor 7,000 miles from our west coast and they're the aggressor? You know. When you're fighting on your own soil, when you're fighting for something you know is essentially right, as I say, toothpicks will overcome tanks. And I think that's one part of the argument where he's wrong. He feels Luther is a sentimentalist at this point. He doesn't address Luther, but Luther is the fellow who's behind it. That finally truth shall win its own battle, independent of the size of the battalions. And Luther felt this very keenly. It's one reason why he could write in the dust of the table in front of Zwingli and as Baton says so well, preserved Western civilization when he did so, when he said, hoc is corpus meum, and that split Protestantism made impossible a common front in a military sense, and it couldn't concern Luther less. He said he hoped he'd die before people thought they could defend truth with military might. Well, Mill does go on to say that eventually and in the long run it's going to win because others will pick it up and finally it'll come because you cannot, ultimately his confidence is, ultimately truth will win. But it may take it 2,000 years. Mills, the gods grind exceedingly slow. Well, that idea that I would say for us who are Christians who live within the gospel, we know that the gospel lives only by controversy. That discussion is continually new necessary. And he speaks of this very well in here, how what you take for granted, what you live with finally has no force in you. It's just a dead truth, and it festers. And I think nobody's put it better than on his essay on education, Alfred North Whitehead, when he deals with that, and it's in the preface to it, when he says, nothing stinks so much as the truth gone sour. I mean, when you try to hold on and say we got the truth, and you preserve it from open debate, open discussion, what you got finally has a stench, smells. And we've had enough of that in our Lutheran church to know how well, how true that is. Well, those overarching statements, there are more here. I found my old copy and found that I made some of the same remarks when I was reading it back when, as I did today when I just skimmed over the first part. We'll read some of it so you get the feel of it, so you get the feel of his style, because it's too good to talk about and not hear it. And he deserves to be heard. We should say just briefly, John Stuart Mill is one of the clearest thinkers in our Western society. He learned his Greek at the age of 4. That's a good time to learn the language. And he kept it. He has a... He had a good mind, and he kept using it. His sense of logic moves through the whole thing, but we are all prisoners of our presuppositions, and he is of his. So you'll have to look as you're reading it to see what are his presuppositions. What are the ones which he accepts, you might say, without debate? Certainly one of them is the one that I made to, that the side which is not afraid to hear what the other side has to say is the one in which ultimately will come out. And that's one of several that he has. But to hear him, you have to hear him as an Englishman of the 19th century, writing in the mid-19th century. He has some presuppositions that are specifically English as a colonial power. And those lesser breeds without the law that require us Englishmen to have even maybe an absolute tyranny, because we know they're good better until they grow up, we've got to kind of train them. And I always think of Quezon at that moment and his remark to us who try to do this in the Philippines. And I am thoroughly sympathetic with him, as I think all of you will be, even with the mess that the Philippines still is. He said he'd rather have the Philippines run like hell from Manila than like heaven from Washington. If you're on the other side, you don't like to be taken care of that well. And that part of it, you notice his assumptions in here. And he addresses this in his discussion. You'll hear that. If you read Fanon at that point, you could hear Fanon shrieking back at him. You Englishmen know how to run the world, so it's better for us to live in. Okay, you know, but it's done with a sense, as he says, and this is another presupposition here, of class. And that a class society, though it thinks about justice to preserve its own power, still has something to be said for itself. And you'll see this very clearly comes into the picture. We'll look at the introduction, and we'll just go through it quickly, in parts, and then we'll have a discussion over against any of the issues you want to bring up in. Once more, realizing we're here in the presence of a masterful mind with a great style and a great deal of clarity. Okay, what he's going to discuss, as he says, this essay on liberty, he said, is not opposed to the misnamed doctrine of philosophical necessity. That's a debate that goes back to Erasmus and Luther and still is around, and we've got it in the midst of our Lutheran church and Jack Preuss's in that picture from way back when. He's not in there on that. He's talking about civil or social liberty, something which Luther says is open to all men and given to us by creation, and there's no argument about it. It's there. The nature and limits of the power which can be legitimately exercised by society over the individual. This is what he's going to discuss. And it's right in the heart of this particular campaign. I can't believe it. I really can't believe it. I mean, I am from a If the government hadn't robbed us like it's done of the power of the money we've got, I would never be paying an income tax. I would be back still under the $3,000 deal, and I wouldn't have to worry about it. It'd be the rich still doing it. What's happened, of course, to money is a joke, because now all those people who out of envy set up this income tax to take money away from the rich and give it back to the poor, they're the ones that's being taken from right now, and that's why you're getting a little howl as labor comes into the $18,000 to $20,000 bracket and suddenly goes over $20,000, you know. A lot of people are voting for Wallace. let's stop giving it away. We used to want them to give it away, but now they're taking my money to give away. You know, and you're not so poor anymore. It's like our best communist amongst the missionaries happened to be from the Northern Presbyterians, and I used to tell them, gee, you want to divvy it up, why don't you start? Your income's twice mine, and let's us start here. No, you want to start divvy up the income. Well, income tax is one of the things there. Is it a legitimate deal? Is it right? Just because another guy's making more, we take it away from him. If he's owning some property, that by my living in the town, and more of us coming in, and more Norwegians coming in, so it's hard for people to find jobs because there's so many Norwegians around, as they said about it in the Depression in Minneapolis, but his property is getting more and more wealthy because so many Norwegians come. Okay, then the money he makes on that property, I think we've got a right to split. But if because he's had some ingenuity, in which sometimes we weren't so quick about amongst us Northies, and he got a new invention and he made some money because of it, and then he's got to split with us, by what right does he have to split? I mean, this is one of the issues that comes into this. Is there any justice in that, really, finally? He's got more than I got. Okay, that's envy. That's not justice. You see? And you end up with what? Well, like we said, Ingrid Bergman paying 105% of his salary. How can you pay 105% of your salary? Well, they expect him to. Dig it up. You've got some savings back there, you know. This is to what she's addressing herself. It's the power of the community over the individual, which is what liberty confronts. It goes on with the second paragraph. All these numberings are the same in your different editions. The struggle between liberty and authority is the most conspicuous feature in the portions of history with which we are earliest familiar, particularly in that of Greece, Rome, and England. But in old times, this contest was between subjects or some classes of subjects and the government. You notice what famous kind of a civilization that shapes us he left out there? It instantly does not come into his thinking.
Hebrew.
The Hebrew. And it's quite a different idea. In Hebrew, you have a fundamental concept of what? Who owns the land?
God.
God owns the land. Since God owns the land, does anybody have a right to that land just because he happens to be on it? And own it now? It's even split up, and every 50 years it's got to go back to the original division, according to the scripture, didn't it? In a year of Jubilee, the original owners got it back, however badly they mismanaged it, and they had a new chance, so the children didn't have to suffer for the stupidity or laziness of the fathers. Okay, it's quite a different deal, and that doesn't come into the discussion here at all. Where that comes in best, incidentally, and it's excellent, John McMurray, The Clue to History, back in the early 20s, is the finest beginning of that discussion in our English-speaking world, and goes on, in which the Hebrew concept of economy and of state and individual is perhaps the clue to history. That's by John McMurray at 20th century, English thinker. It's a new ball game in the 20th century at that point. That won't come into this discussion. All right, liberty, authority, from that Greek-Roman tradition only, and its effects in England. By liberty, verse the 20th line, by liberty was meant protection against the tyranny of the political rulers. The rulers were conceived, except in some of the popular governments of Greece, as in a necessarily antagonistic position to the people whom they ruled. In other words, a fundamental opposition between ruler and rule was a presupposition of how we got to protect ourselves from them. They consisted of a governing one or a governing tribe or caste who derived their authority from inheritance or conquest, who at all events did not hold it at the pleasure of the governed, and whose supremacy men did not venture, perhaps did not desire to contest, whatever precautions might be taken against its oppressive exercise. Their power was regarded as necessary, but also as highly dangerous, as a weapon which they would attempt to use against their subjects no less than against external enemies. And he discusses this, that because they got some protection, it's worth giving up some freedom. And for the sake of the protection, maybe the freedom is worth it. But limits had to be set, verse the 40th line. The aim, therefore, patriots, was to set limits to the power which the ruler should be suffered to exercise over the community. And this limitation is what they meant by liberty. And he speaks of by rights and by constitutional checks. Bill of Rights and by constitutional check are the two ways in which the consent of the government had to come into the picture as mankind developed. And he concludes that paragraph, very logical paragraph, with the final sentence, and so long as mankind were content to combat one enemy by another and be ruled by a master on condition of being guaranteed more or less efficaciously against this tyranny, they did not carry their aspirations beyond this point. In other words, even with the kind of a fiefdom that they had, and you had to be bound to the property, if you got protection, you could live with your family, and so on, you let it go. Now, representative government came into the picture, and that's what he goes on with the next paragraph, discuss representative government as it came, see. Now, and I'll just read from about line 18 there. What was now wanted, 78 rather, what was now wanted was that the rulers should be identified with the people, that their interest and will should be the interest and will of the nation. The nation did not need to be protected against its own will. There was no fear of its tyrannizing over itself. let the rulers be effectually responsible to it, promptly removable by it, and could afford to trust them with a power of which it could itself dictate the use to be made. Their power was but the nation's own power concentrated and in a form convenient for exercise. This mode of thought, or perhaps a feeling, was common among the last generation of European liberalism, he's thinking up to the Revolution of 1848, in the continental section which it still apparently predominates. Those who admit any limit to what a government may do, except in the case of such governments as they think ought not to exist, stand out as brilliant exceptions among the political thinkers of the continent. In other words, they were now representative, and therefore what they did was the will of the people. Now he goes on in the next paragraph to say, but success of that system showed its failures. And where the failures were. He goes on with the French Revolution and about 103, and he continues to say that that in time, however, with verse 108, in time, however, a democratic republic came to occupy a large proportion of the earth's surface and made itself felt as one of the most powerful members of the community of nations. An elective and responsible government became subject to the observations and criticisms which weighed upon a great existing fact. It was now perceived that such phrases as self-government and the power of the people over themselves do not express the true state of the case. And now we get into something discussed in your Bible study even this morning about not being subject to what people think. What will they think that Heidegger deals with in his philosophy and so on. Now you've got the tyranny of a majority. And you've got a persecution of the minority by a majority who set up the reigning thing. This is what he discusses. Now, where liberty again gets to be really threatened. The people who exercise the power are not always the same people with those over whom it is exercised. And the self-government spoken of is not the government of each by himself, but of each by all the rest. The will of the people, however, practically means the will of the most numerous and most active part of the people, the majority, or those who succeed in making themselves accepted as the majority. What a wonderful line to apply to Jake Price and the majority, as they call themselves in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which we know is a minority, but very political, apt to make them look like a majority. They've done a good job on it. The youth survey showed that 67% of Missouri Synod wanted union now, and when Jack Price saw that, he thought he had to get busy, and he did. He did a good job of making the minority call themselves a majority, and they call themselves a majority. You feel better if you're the majority, in other words. Or those who succeed in making themselves accepted as a majority. The people consequently may desire to oppress a part of their number, and precautions are as much needed against this as against any other abuse of power. I may say that English have been much better than that, than we in Americans, and the eccentrics and the oddballs have always had, I feel, a very much more secure place within English society than they have in ours. But some of that, according to what we read now in the English periodicals we get here, is now threatened. Even there, it's getting a little uncomfortable. You don't like to have anybody that different. This view of things, he says, I'm going to skip the rest of the paragraphs, fairly clear. This tyranny of the majority, you know what it means. It's now generally included amongst the evils against which society requires to be on its guard. And you, all of you who are in the village, are very sensitive to this aspect. And you'll go on and discuss it through custom, through habit, through how you cut your hair, or have a beard or don't have a beard, and so on. I'm going to read the next paragraph because I think it's very good. And it applies right now to, I think, a peculiar tyranny of those who say they represent the ecological interests. The Concorde just took off from the airport, and all the people that were within the path of the Concorde through the next few miles were asked if they noticed any noise, and none of them did. They said it was beautiful, it was awe-inspiring, it was breathtaking. And meanwhile, after all this has happened, everybody is still against allowing it to land in America. Well, for one thing, only the rich are going to get the advantage of it, and why should they have the advantage? And it still makes noise, but like all the rest of our planes that are landing and not landing. But unfortunately, it also was made by whom? Huh?
French and British.
Yeah, French and British. Did any of that come into our thinking? Oh, we got a group ego just as much as any other people, and we didn't allow it to be built in America. And they've got it. And Boeing wasn't permitted to produce it because it was going to make so much noise. And now it surprises everybody. It really isn't making any more noise than any of the others. You see? Boy, the ecology people will not admit that. We're speaking about that kind of tyranny, of this kind of a group that we've got from the ecology gang now. Like other tyrannies, the tyranny of the majority was at first and still vulgarly held in dread, chiefly as operating through the acts of all of the public authorities. But reflecting persons perceive that when society is itself the tyrant, society collectively over the separate individuals who compose it, its means of tyrannizing are not restricted to the acts which it may do by the hands of its political functionaries. Society can and does execute its own mandates. That is a prevailing fad. See? The prevailing in thing to be with. And I think this is so important for us to see, because this tyrannizes us more really in our American society than anything else. You hate to be out of step. You hate to be not in the fashion. You hate to be not speaking the current lingo. And so older people speak a language that isn't native to them, and they sound ridiculous, and it is always a cause for laughter by the younger ones, but they think they're in by doing it, you know. Okay, that's a social mandate. If it issues wrong mandates instead of right, or any mandates at all, and things with which it ought not to meddle. And this now is the touch always of any humanism. It's in Marx, beautifully stated there too, for man is made merely a hand, and where you start interfering with his whole meaning of his whole personhood and so on. This is a touch of humanism, and it's a great thing to have. In things with which it ought not to meddle, it practices a social tyranny more formidable than many kinds of political oppression. Boy, you people all felt that, see? This is why you've got long hair right now. And I thought it was real fun from either Xerox or Kaiser Corporation, I don't remember which, they put out good magazines every once in a while, and this one was on one of the great contributions of the hippie movement to American culture. That you don't have to look like an undertaker's assistant to sell refrigerators is one of the points they made. Well, now, this is an oppression. When the St. Olaf Choir sang at Harvard, I was so thankful to be at St. Olaf, for not one of us had the same haircut. Everybody at Harvard had Heine. The whole bunch. I couldn't believe it. I looked around. You know, there wasn't a single person without a Heine.
Did you all get there when you got in?
No, none of us bothered to get in. We were Norwegians. It didn't have to be in. We were used to being out of step. But see, we wouldn't know how to act if we weren't. You've heard the best Norwegian joke I've heard for a long time lately that sums us up very much. Mary says only Norwegians can understand even the humor of the joke. It's one Norwegian to the other saying, "Boy, we sure got everything good here in Norway," and the other Norwegian says, "Yeah, and that's all we got." Or any mandates at all in things with which it ought not to meddle. It practices a social tyranny more formidable than many kinds of political oppression. Boy, you people all felt that, see? This is why you've got long hair right now. And I thought it was real fun from either Xerox or Kaiser Corporation, I don't remember which, they put out good magazines every once in a while, and this one was on one of the great contributions of the hippie movement to American culture. That you don't have to look like an undertaker's assistant to sell refrigerators is one of the points they made. Well, now, this is an oppression. When the St. Olaf Choir sang at Harvard, I was so thankful to be at St. Olaf, for not one of us had the same haircut. Everybody at Harvard had Heine. The whole bunch. I couldn't believe it. I looked around. You know, there wasn't a single person without a Heine.
Did you all get there when you got in?
No, none of us bothered to get in. We were Norwegians. It didn't have to be in. We were used to being out of step. We wouldn't know how to act if we weren't. You've heard the best Norwegian joke I've heard for a long time lately that sums us up very much. Mary says only Norwegians can understand even the humor of the joke. It's one Norwegian to the other saying, "Boy, we sure got everything good here in Norway," and the other Norwegian says, "Yeah, and that's all we got." Or any mandates at all in things with which it ought not to meddle. It practices a social tyranny more formidable than many kinds of political oppression. Since, though not usually upheld by such extreme penalties, it leaves fewer means of escape, penetrating much more deeply into the details of life and enslaving the soul itself. Carl Solberg did not get the Rhodes Scholarship from our area, though he certainly had it coming, because he did not know how to dance or play bridge. He was another one of these stupid Norwegians from St. Olaf. So he went out and started a county newspaper out at Rugby, North Dakota that winter, and took it in the other area where they allowed people still to go to Oxford even though they didn't dance or play bridge. But you see, that kind of a mandate, see, that you gotta, if it comes a revolution, you're gonna eat strawberries, but I don't like strawberries. Comes a revolution, you eat strawberries and like them, you know. This kind of a of a whole that's always present in every society. I suppose if somebody came to the village, we'd say, if you want to come up here and sleep all the time, you can. Don't go to anything. You're pretty wild. If somebody did do that, I suppose it would be disturbed a little bit. Maybe we wouldn't. I don't know. Maybe we really are true to that mandate. We say we're not going to allow anybody to come under that kind of a mandate of the village, that you better be with it, and so on. Protection, therefore, against the tyranny of the magistrate is not enough. There needs protection also against the tyranny of the prevailing opinion and feeling, against the tendency of society to impose by other means than civil penalties its own ideas and practices as rules of conduct on those who dissent from them, to fetter the development, if possible, prevent the formation of any individuality not in harmony with its ways, and compel all characters to fashion themselves upon the model of its own. I was coming back first class on the Grips home from Europe to America, as the government was paying for it. I'd had a Fulbright Class A, and that gives you sort of semi-ambassadorial status. And my particular table, which I was eating first class, I remember the treasurer of the New York Times was there, and the ship's doctor, and so on. In my particular table, which I was eating first class, I remember the treasurer of the New York Times was there, and the ship's doctor, and so on. And when I preached on Sunday, all the first class came, because I was one of them. I was sitting there, see? And of course, the rest and the others came, because most of them knew me from someplace, the other Swedes from Duluth, Grand Forks, etc. So we were jamming, and you had to stand around. And then they gave me a box of beautiful Havana afterwards, and a lion gave me a nice little Swedish glass thing. And I said, because I had a beard and you know, everything, and at that time people didn't. This was 1961. And I said, gee, isn't it peculiar how the world accepts a guy, even though I got a beard and so on, and the church really has a hard time making any room for me. And I remember the treasurer of the New York Times said, yeah, but there's a lot more room in the world than the church. And I said, no, that's just where you're wrong. There should be a lot more room in the church than the world, isn't there? And yet here we are, a bishop, scolding the congregation for supporting this worthless place because of all those long-haired guys up there and those bearded CEOs that happened just now. And one of Johann's congregations sent us $200 last year. They should have given it to Johann for his salary instead. But that there's a place for people who aren't all the same. Isn't that something? I remember, you know, when we were talking with George Shultz and Ken Preby about the support of this place. Of course, they weren't planning to support it personally, and they didn't think the church would support it either. And George Shultz, who got good intelligence, he said, well, after all, why should the church support something that doesn't appeal to 10% of its members? 10%? I said, 2%. And that is 2%. But I said, it's the 2% that's going to shape the next century. And shouldn't the church have some place for them? The ones that want to think, the ones that don't want to go to a place with the answers, but where they may go out more disturbed than they came? Like one guy came to me last summer, and he was pulling my leg, but I thought he meant it. I came up here expecting an answer, got more questions I came. And I said, yeah, aren't you glad a place like that? If it weren't that kind of place, I wouldn't be back again. No, but you see, this kind of an openness, this is what he's arguing for, that this kind of a society should allow room for all its members. And yet, outside the Church of Jesus Christ, is there room for all its members? You're in a good company when you're taken through for being with long hairs and so on, because that was what they criticized our Lord for, didn't they? But it doesn't make us where our Lord is just by being criticized for it, but at least it's, to that extent, it's good company. Anyway, he says, prevent the formation of any individually not in harmony with its ways, and compel all characters to fashion themselves upon the model of its own. There is a limit to the legitimate interference of collective opinion with individual independence, And to find that limit and maintain it against encroachment is as indispensable as to a good condition of human affairs as protection against political despotism. Now, one thing that helps us in this is a little bit of travel to realize there's a geography of morals. And he goes into this in the next paragraph. When we sent 340-some parish workers from our old Evangelical Lutheran Church to the Hanover Lutheran World Federation, they had a meeting of the women workers in the church before or after Hanover. I don't know which, because I wasn't there, but I had put on a big campaign to get these gals sent over, because they don't get that much salary or that much time to themselves, and they should get this. And Bishop Jonsson, he wasn't a bishop then, he was pastor of one of our favorite congregations in Oslo, a thriller to go to. It's got a great ceiling, unlike our center, which hopefully someday may, and also three statues that lead you up the altar, namely back to King Olaf and with his sword, and then Hans Christian, Hans Nielsen Hauge with his spade, and Luther with his Bible, and Hans Christian Nielsen with his Hauge with his spades. Beautiful church. But anyway, he said on the Norwegian radio, summing up what happened, when these particular women from America came in, where already were gathered the deaconesses and other women who worked from the churches in Europe. And he called it geography of morals, and this cost him his election to bishop for another 6-7 years, actually. Didn't get it right away, because it was such an offense to the people of Norway. Because in Norway, they know what's right. And if you're a Christian, you don't use lipstick and rouge. It just doesn't happen. In fact, you're not genuine. They did say about one of our missionaries, a flaming redhead who used lipstick, that ja, hun sminkte, men hun var jo ekte, was one of the first things we heard when we came up. She did use cosmetics, but she was a sincere person. Tough to take. Well, these gals came in, you see, where all these women were sitting from Europe, and there was an audible gasp from all these Europeans as they saw these gals came in looking like they come from Hollywood. You know, a little bit more up-to-date clothing, and high heels, and rouge and lipstick, and hairdos, and looked like they were sending over here like this kind of move.
That was real stylish.
Yeah, well, that was mobile unit, you know, like they used to have at the time of the Huguenots, remember, when the Queen put some mobile units to work on the French Huguenot men. And that's about the way these gals look. They've been sent over sort of to seduce the Europeans. And there was just sort of a look of shock from the European gals as they blew the smoke from their cigars. And our gals, you know, just happened to look at all these gals smoking cigars. Well, geography of morals. Does good to just travel a little bit and see that this has nothing to do. See, nothing to do with it. You can laugh at it. But they really can't laugh at it. Remember a cousin of mine, Oxford Moon won a particular girl to Jesus Christ we had met, and was a really glowing person. And this cousin said, yeah, she still goes on dancing. She pretends to be a Christian. You know, this is impossible. Well, that geography of morals in judging each other, he brings in this next paragraph, that this is custom. And as he says about it, it's a vicious thing because you can't get at it. It's unreflective. He goes on, as he says in 176 line there, well, starting at 173. No two ages, and scarcely any two countries, have decided it alike. And the decision of one age or country is a wonder to another. Yet the people of any given age and country no more suspect any difficulty in it than if it were a subject on which mankind had always been agreed. I mean, in St. Olaf in my day, we fellows took for granted as one way to tell what kind of girl you had. If she smoked, she'll do anything else, and if that's what you wanted, you want all the girls to smoke. And that day it worked. It didn't work. Fairly quick, it wasn't true. His guys found out and came back with black eyes. The rules which obtain among themselves appear to them self-evident and self-justifying. This all but universal illusion is one of the examples of the magical influence of custom, which is not only, as the proverb says, a second nature, but is continually mistaken for the first. A little dry humor from John Stuart Mill. The effect of custom in preventing any misgiving respecting the rules of conduct which mankind impose on one another is all the more complete because the subject is one on which it is not generally considered necessary that reasons should be given, either by one person to others or by each to himself. You do it because that's the way you're brought up, that's all. I mean, I know playing with playing cards is sin. I was brought up that way, and I burn them when I see them, you see. People are accustomed to believe and have been encouraged in the belief by some who aspire to the character of philosophers that their feelings on subjects of this nature are better than reasons and render reasons unnecessary. That's the way we English do it. What he's talking about here. Well, this is a terrible kind of tyranny. It's a brainwashing, isn't it? And we have said this in the village by the very tremendous group of youth we had in the second year of our lifestyle in Richmond. We had an all-night argument in the sauna with me, with one group on one side, and in the dining room with one of our guys who had been really converted through an encounter movement into the Episcopalian Church in the dining room. And it was started out of the encounter movement, which I had a dandy essay in the American Scholar that fall on, does the encounter movement destroy the image of man? And the answer was in the affirmative by a professor of philosophy, a Jewish man, at Boston University. And they really researched this out in a beautiful article by Janie Larson, whose father's in this, and got his PhD in it, in fact, in that whole movement. And she had worked it out very carefully, and we'd argued, and we finally came to a common decision, both of us separately from each other, as we joined to talk over where we were at. Anytime you're in any kind of an encounter, Alcoholics Anonymous, Salem Lutheran Church, whatever it may be, where there are not clearly defined presuppositions and where content is not central to the formation of the fellowship, you're brainwashed. You're subject to manipulation. And that, I'd say, is true. This is what we pounded out through the night. And this is what he's getting at here, see. Unless you're reflecting on it, seeing what it's at, what it is that's shaping your customs as well as your laws, and seeing the folly and the relativism of them, you are yourself brainwashed, and you'll be brainwashing others. You're going to bring up kids like you are going to be just as uptight. And what's the tragedy? He says you become an echo, really. You don't become a person. Now, this is from a humanistic point of view, he's arguing simply. Like Heidegger is from Das Mann, what will they think? What will they think? And he says on top of page 6 here, in lines before you get to 200, he starts speaking to that. No one indeed acknowledges to himself that his standard of judgment is his own liking, but an opinion on a point of conduct, not supported by reasons, can only count as one person's preference. And if the reasons when given are a mere appeal to a similar preference felt by other people, it is still only many people's liking instead of one. I mean, this is how we Norwegians feel. If you enjoin it, it's sin. That's all. And after all, we Norwegians, being amongst the more intelligent minorities on this earth, having decided that whatever is enjoyable is sin, we're right and stop. Just listen to us and take part. But, however, we'll join with you Germans so you can share our superior piety, and maybe we can even get you to be a little more pious by joining with you, which was said when we came to this merger with the ALC back when. However, the old ELC had the grace to laugh when one of our pastors said it. They need us because we're so much more pious than they are. To an ordinary man, however, his own preference thus supported is not only a perfectly satisfactory reason, but the only one he generally has for any of his notions of morality, taste, or propriety, which are not expressly written in his religious creed, and his chief guide in his interpretation even of that. In other words, your customs reflect back on your creed, even, see. A really earnest Christian is not going to be drinking beer. He gives that up when he becomes a Christian and only drinks water. But he may drink some beer in his back porch or when he goes to Europe. I only did it when I went to Europe, which is an expensive glass of beer. And you've got to pay for that trip back and forth and so on. Men's opinions, accordingly, on what is laudable or blamable are affected by all the multifarious causes which influence their wishes in regard to the conduct of others, and which are as numerous as those which determine their wishes on any other subject. Sometimes their reason, at other times their prejudices or superstitions, often their social affections, not seldom their antisocial ones. And I think this has been well seen by some of us who looked at this Norwegian piety, antisocial. The Yankees, those who didn't have a brogue, those who made more money and were hiring us, they could afford to have a cocktail. Therefore, you know a cocktail is wrong. That belongs to those rich bitches. You see, and this is how we felt inside. Our hymn said it very well. All are like before the highest, he raiseth up and he makes low. He'll raise thee up, though low thou liest. He'll bring that rich man poor and low. True wonders still by him are wrought, who raise up and brings down. I like that stanza. I wish I hadn't read hymnary. I think it belongs. There's some real truth in it. It comes from the Magnificat, even. But to say that your customs determine that, see. This is the problem. He says sometimes their reason has this kind of antisocial, their envy or jealousy, their arrogance or contemptuousness, but most commonly their desires or fears for themselves, their legitimate or illegitimate self-interest. Where there is an ascendant class, a large portion of the morality of the country emanates from its class interests and its feeling of class superiority. Now, that's what we spoke about as SK's aesthetic level. Again, you're just being pushed. It's your fears that push you in it. It's no real decision in this issue, but custom has shaped you, and you become merely an echo of each other. but you do it in order to get in, to be in with the in-group. Where on the other hand, a class formerly ascended has lost its ascendancy, where its ascendancy is unpopular, then people will allow their hair to grow longer and will start wearing beards, see, in spite of the fact that it's hard on the barbers. Before, you never dared have anything that even was a little bit showing beyond your ears. See. Another grand determining principle of the rules of conduct, both in act and forbearance, which have been enforced by law or opinion, has been the servility of mankind towards the supposed preferences or aversions of their temporal masters or of their gods or of people from whom you've got to beg money for Holden Village. This servility, though essentially selfish, is not hypocrisy. It gives rise to perfectly genuine sentiments of abhorrence. It made men burn magicians and heretics. I remember when I didn't get in the seminary, all Al told me as to the decision of the faculty, well, he told me a little bit more on that, but the first thing he says, you know, you don't always brush your shoes. And that was abhorrent, you see.
Carol?
Yeah?
Can you explain that, about servility being selfish?
Well, you're doing it for your own ends, you see. You're playing up to the ruling class and playing into them. Like Harvard says, you know, after all, you want to get on? Marry the boss's daughter. Don't disagree with the boss. There's no point in having opinions of your own. Your problem is to get on. Run the corporation. See what I mean? That servility? Every time I had a call to a college, my father-in-law always got with me very quickly, so I'd be sure and turn it down, or he knew he'd soon be supporting me, for one thing. And the other thing is, wait, if you ever get a chance to be on the steamroller driving it, okay. But don't go there, because the steamroller is sure going to roll right over you. See? You haven't got a chance in any college. I mean, he was very clear about it, and he was a good politician. I mean, you have to play up to that in-group feeling, see? Unless in faculty meetings you can enjoy the laughter over this stupid guy and not say, as I was unfortunate enough to say, when one of the men was laughing, he's not in seminary anymore, he's gone to a college where he teaches. But I said, gee, you know, you remind me of just the pastors that I used to have to take through when I was in the youth movement. We're always talking about these unspiritual people here, but this is where God has put me. I said, if you aren't smarter than those guys in your class, what are you doing being a teacher? He's a very good teacher and a very smart guy. But he got a little mad at the comment. You know, you don't take a kind of gleeful feeling in that kind of a relationship, can you? But an in-group does, and doesn't look at it. I mean, it has its own kind of jokes, its own kind of sort of secret handshake in order to put another guy down and build themselves up. That's status, isn't it? And this is just what Ephesians says you can never do. You can never threaten anyone by your status, master to servant and so on. Paul uses that word threaten, that others are threatened. I mean, if he's got to speak the English language just as you do, and wear his tie like you do, or he's not welcome in your home, you see, or to marry your daughter. Remember when one of the beautiful guys from here married a beautiful girl, and I did tell a father, and it helped him a great deal. I could be very proud if you're my son-in-law. I knew he was uptight because big red bushy hair and long red deal, and it always had a chip on each shoulder, but an honest one, and a great guy. He's going to be at Wartburg Seminary next year. And that's where sometimes the peer group again is unfair, isn't it? Maybe some guys like to have their hair cut short like Kurt right now. Okay. You still got to say hello to them. You know? Yeah. Well, this is what he's speaking to, see? And it makes you burn magicians and heretics. This fear of the stranger, this fear of anybody who's different, see?
People on the other side are also considered suspect. I mean, what if you do have your hair?
There aren't that many when he's writing this, or he would have said it, I'm sure, Mary.
But I mean, I think you do have to include that, because yes. I think he would have.
Yeah, I did just now. I said it myself. I added this to him. I think he would have too. But at the time he's writing, the class distinction is such in well, you know, Shaw in the 20th century, a long time later, is writing My Fair Lady on it. You know, you don't have the right accent, you aren't one of us, and so. And that's beautifully done, isn't it, in that play. I just think one of the best scenes is that, where she's talking about her mother, remember? Who, at that race, how did she put it again? When she breaks out of the accent and says she took something, she'd done her in, oh yeah, she'd done her in, remember? And of course, one of the class guys on the opposite side was taken with her immediately. That happens across the lines. having less to do with the way you pronounce things and the way you walk and what you carry under your neck as well as above. Less, however, as a matter of reason and on their own account than as a consequence of the sympathies and antipathies which grew out of them. And sympathies and antipathies which had little or nothing to do with the interest of society have made themselves felt in the establishment of moralities with quite as great force. Now, the Normans did this to the Anglo-Saxons, and that came out very well in that movie on Becket, Thomas of Becket, remember? And the Anglo-Saxons then were the clods, and the Normans were in, remember? Because they had won the war, and they'd set up the rules, and established practices, and the natives of England were out, were clods. They came back in later, not least helped by the Wesleyan movement, but it took them a while. He goes on then to speak, and I'll just read just from 250 on. I want to skip over a little bit further, but now he's arguing. What he's arguing for here is an open or pluralistic society in which minorities confront each other freely in conversation which is not under fear or under the kind of brainwashing of unreflected custom from prior generations, but actually are encountering each other for the establishment of what is a real liberty. And this is what he now addresses. Now he's ready for it. This is from just the introduction. Line 250, I'll take that. They have occupied themselves rather in inquiring what things society ought to like or dislike than in questioning whether its likings or dislikes should be a law to individuals. They preferred endeavoring to alter the feelings of mankind on the particular points on which they themselves were heretical rather than make common cause in defense of freedom with heretics generally. The only case in which the higher ground has been taken on principle, you're speaking to what Mary talked about, though, the only case in which the higher ground has been taken on principle and maintained with consistency by any but an individual here and there is that of religious belief. I mean, in religious belief, you have established a pluralism, he's saying, in the English-speaking world. A case instructive in many ways, and not least so as forming a most striking instance of the fallibility of what is called a moral sense. For the odium theologicum, this is the desire of theologians to always flip chips, our polemical natures. We love an argument. And we'll travel 2,000 miles for a good one. That's why we're alive here at the village. For the odium theologicum in a sincere bigot is one of the most unequivocal cases of moral feeling. He knows he's right, and he still lets you have a chance over. Those who first broke the yoke of what called itself the universal church were in general as little willing to permit differences of religious opinion as that church itself. But when the heat of the conflict was over, without giving a complete victory to any party, and each church or sect was reduced to limit its hopes to retaining possession of the ground it already occupied, minorities, seeing that they had no chance of becoming majorities, were under the necessity of pleading to those whom they could not convert for permission to differ. Now that is the heart of our liberty situation. Till this hour in American democracy and so on. It comes out of that conflict situation which no majority won, so they had to allow the other to live, and they had then to allow for minority pressures. And everything in our society is dependent on minority pressures. That's what American democracy is. And if you're not part of one of those, and you're complaining, you got it coming, because all you have to do is become part of minority pressure, and you'd be surprised what you get. We discovered one little minority today called the Undertakers. It put so much pressure on that everybody's got to be buried now in a cement, sealed kind of container, so you aren't even allowed in your death to enrich the ground. Hardly has anything to do with ecology, but they claim this was a big ecological, cleanliness. Seal you down tight. I just hope they got me dead first. That's one of my nightmares. It is, accordingly, on this battlefield, almost solely, that the rights of the individual against society have been asserted on broad grounds of principle, and the claim of society exercised over dissensions openly controverted. In other words, this issue within the Protestant world is what opened up society for the possibility of parties and of respect for one another in opposite parties and so on. This is its source, and he sees this as a humanist very, very much so, and it's true. The great writers to whom the world owes what religious liberty possesses have mostly asserted freedom of conscience as an indefeasible right and denied absolutely that a human being is accountable to others for his religious belief. Yet so natural to mankind is intolerance and whatever they really care about, and this is a very important thing, and this is true, what he's saying now, that religious freedom has hardly anywhere been practically realized except for religious indifference, which dislikes to have its peace disturbed by theological quarrels, has added its weight to the scale. In other words, it's peaceable time. Let's quit it. Blessed are we when we'll all eat in the kingdom of heaven. Remember that nice pious person that interrupted the conversation in Luke 14 as things were getting a little hot at the party? And then I said, yes, and not all of you who talk about heaven are going there. And Jesus goes on and tells the story. Remember? It's quite a laughter chapter if you look at it. He's at a party and wham, bang. The guy, the host is taken through, invites us, the people invite him back. The guests are taken through because they want the front seats. And so the lady interrupts, oh, it's going to be wonderful. We all eat bread in the kingdom of heaven. Let's change the subject. Let's not get into these heated things. And then Jesus says, yes, and not everybody talking about heaven's going to go there. Wow. No. Well, this is what he's speaking to. A little indifference helped a little bit. In the minds of almost all religious persons, even the most tolerant countries, the duty of toleration is admitted with tacit reserves. One person will bear with dissent in matters of church government, but not of dogma. Another can tolerate everybody short of a papist or Unitarian. Another, everyone who believes in a revealed religion. A few extend their charities a little further, but stop at a belief in God and future state. And he'll come back at this as he goes on. This sort of a thing. This belief in God and future state is almost essential in English-speaking world for some sort of a permission to speak up. Whatever the sentiment of the majority is still genuine, and wherever the sentiment of the majority is still genuine, Kent has found abated little of its claim to be obeyed. And I find this very true, and I've always used this within my parish ministries as an argument to these people, say, when all you Christians get together, I'll be in church. And I've always answered, you bet you will. You'll either be in church and in jail. What do you mean? When we all get together, we'll have the law such that if you aren't in church, you'll be in jail. No, and that's just the way it gets used, doesn't it? So it may be a good thing. Now he goes on, and J.B. Priestley has got a dandy book on English, which I read a week ago. It's real fun. And really what he's talking about here, you almost have to say, is true just for England, and he's saying that. The English have understood what we talked about under marriage a few days ago from Jung. And Priestley takes that as a theme for his whole book on the English, that they, without having read Jung, most of them still understand what he talks about when he says about living with your shadow, being able to accept the feminine in man and the masculine in woman, and living with that in terms of seeing a depth consciousness that very much supporting what I'll be talking about tonight in my sermon briefly, that nonsense is the only way you get any sense. Their hatred of the rational in the English-speaking world. A good Englishman is an anti-rationalist. The so-called age of reason never did really take with a true Englishman. The whole deism of the machinery of God and a world all operating perfectly, they muddle through. This is the English way. And muddling through, you give room for all the other muddlers. So there's a little room for each other. And he quotes somebody saying that it's so wonderful, every time I come back to England, once more I hear about ghosts. It's the only place where they actually believe in ghosts, you know, things like that. And it's kind of fun to have a society like that. And he's speaking about this in terms of room for each other. And that's what he's speaking about. And I would have to say that this is true. I think in England, even the Liberal Party is still actually liberal. I would not be able to say, as I say about every liberal I know in America who calls himself a liberal, I have to say to hell with the liberals. Because what they mean is a government that actually controls you, that says how much money you can keep, that decides how much money you're going to give away, and that it really structures your life in such a way that it almost gets beyond bearing. Because a liberal in American society leaves little room for any kind of liberty. But in the English-speaking world, there still is that. They didn't have the kind of legalistic self-righteousness and priggishness as I see, generally speaking, of the so-called liberals that I've had on my board at Holden Village. I really have been upset with them because they would have made this place into a kind of prison in which you're allowed to think as long as you think our way. And that is the worst. That became for a while the new kind of law. They wouldn't support this place because we weren't in the ghetto serving blacks. That's the only place where the church should be right now. And it got to be ridiculous. And I wrote a little letter to Paul Bull and to Schutz that disturbed him so much they had lunch together and wondered if I was near suicide. But I said, if I ever commit suicide, you'll find a note on my chest saying he had a church which would not support him unless he was black and living in the inner city. I mean, this was the big thing for a little while. And New York Times and National Observer and some others wrote editorials to this point. I mean, you mean all arrestors should be left without pastors? There's to be nowhere else any sense of this freedom that Jesus Christ gives in the parish ministry? But you've got to be in that kind of a desperate social situation, and then somebody can care for you. But meanwhile, you aren't worth caring about because you live in a suburb. You know, that kind of attitude. Remember it? We had it back a few years back. And that's our American liberal. Well, that, he's talking against that, that in the English liberal society, you've got a different kind of a notion. It has some humor and some distinction and so on, some real thinking about his presuppositions. And I go along with him on this. And he speaks about, finally, for a liberal, you have to see that the only kind of coercion or power that can be given to any community over against any individual is to keep him from doing harm to others, to prevent harm to others. That's the sole principle for liberty, self-protection. His own good, either physical or moral, is not a sufficient warrant. All these guys knew my own good, and they were out, you know, to make me over in their image. His own good, either physical or moral, is not a sufficient warrant. He cannot rightfully be compelled to do or forbear, because it will be better for him to do so, because it will make him happier. People like you better. Just talk, Lord Carroll. There's nothing the Lutheran Church won't give you. Jerry Pelican told me that one time. I said, in other words, I'm going to carry on a kind of big hocus-pocus, and then I get accepted. You know, because in the opinions of others, to do so would be wise or even right. These are good reasons for remonstrating with him, or reasoning with him, or persuading him, or entreating him, but not for compelling him or visiting him with evil in case you do otherwise. The only place that's good for you is 55 miles from the nearest telephone, or people got to spend a day to get there once they're there. Then they got it coming. See, that sort of feeling. That we give them the silent treatment. That used to be the big thing amongst our bishops back in the old days when I started something called a fullness series to get some real theology in print again, instead of just devotional things with which we all more or less would agree. And get things with which we violently disagree, so we'd have theology going once more. And give him a silent treatment. Well, that's simply the worst kind of a punishment, isn't it? As William James said a long time ago, the isolation. Now he speaks about maturity in this. For this kind of a society, it takes some maturity. I used to say at St. Olaf back in those days that there was no question about women having a soul. It's something Christianity had always accepted. The big argument was, do they have a mind? Because women were the ones that most resented anybody who was having an argument above any kind of a normal social tone. In fact, who would have any kind of argument at all. You didn't go on dates to have arguments, and I was spoiling them. And some of them didn't like me because I had what we call literary picnics for the purpose of having arguments in our blanket parties. And it was sort of fun to have these two things together. I wasn't against the one, but I wanted for the other. And to have something both above and below the shoulders. This requires certain maturity, and the women were not at that time still ready for it. Your feeling about college was a place to go and get the right guy. You found a Christian that you were going to marry. And the best thing was just to be a little quiet about your own convictions, because that makes distinctions. Some guys won't like you.